From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, 6 Feet Under. The HBO show about a family that runs a funeral home breathes its last breath this weekend, with the series finale airing Sunday night. We'll listen back to our interview with Alan Ball, the show's creator. He won an Oscar for his screenplay for American Beauty. We'll also hear from actor Michael C. Hall, who plays David Fisher, the gay brother on the show, and from actress Lauren Ambrose, who plays troubled daughter Claire. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the thriller Red Eye and the comedy The 40-Year-Old Virgin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. 6 Feet Under, the HBO series about life, death, and the meaning of love and family, concludes its 5-season run this Sunday. In a moment, we'll listen to Terry's interviews with Alan Ball, the show's creator, who wrote and directed the finale, and with Michael C. Hall and Lauren Ambrose, who play siblings David and Claire Fisher. But first, as the TV critic around here, I'd like to put 6 Feet Under in perspective and give the show its due. The first episode of 6 Feet Under, presented by HBO in 2001, began with Nathaniel Fisher Sr., the patriarch of Fisher & Son's funeral home, being hit by a bus in a freak traffic accident. His surviving family members had to deal not only with the loss, but with preparing the body for services and both planning and hosting the funeral. The family members, when we first met them, were a mess. Widow Ruth, played by Frances Conroy, almost imploded with grief and anger. Closeted gay son David, played by Michael C. Hall, was wound way too tightly. Prodigal son Nate, played by Peter Krause, wanted no part of the family funeral business and not much to do with the family. And little sister Claire, played by young Lauren Ambrose, was high on crystal meth when she got the news that her father was dead. The only person at Fisher & Sons who seemed at all together then was Federico Diaz, played by Freddie Rodriguez, and he was just an employee, an artist gifted at preparing bodies for public viewings. What we didn't know, watching that first episode, was how many of the characters and concepts introduced then would deepen and resonate over the years. The opening death scene, in which Richard Jenkins as Nathaniel was killed while driving a hearse, turned out to be a recurring motif. Each episode began with a death, some horrific, some ghoulishly amusing. And that body ultimately would show up later in the episode to be dealt with at Fisher & Sons. Another recurring theme established with Nathaniel the father was the haunting. After his death, Nathaniel would appear at times and interact with initially spooked, eventually accepting family members. Many other corpses later displayed that same ability, from loved ones to total strangers. Some dispensed advice or offered perspective. Others complained or ridiculed. And a third recurring element was the fade to white, a knowing nod to the follow-the-light concept of the gateway to the afterlife. Some scenes would fade to white and merely shift to the next scene. Others would register the end of a life by displaying that character's name and the years of his or her birth and death. A few weeks ago, series creator Alan Ball pulled an unexpected surprise by fading to white after Nate Fisher, the son and central character, seemed to be recovering from a second cerebral embolism. The white screen seemed to linger. Then Nate's name, with the year of his death as 2005, finally came up. It was a shock. But if you followed 6 Feet Under the whole way, it was not only foreshadowed and justifiable, it was inevitable. The series always has been about the fragility of life, the suddenness of death, and the importance of grasping at happiness and supporting family along the way. This could have been a sticky, sweet sermon, but the Fishers, much as they loved one another, weren't very good at expressing it or at forging lasting relationships. Nate married and buried a wife over the course of the show and had a long-standing, volatile affair with another woman he eventually married, Brenda, played by Rachel Griffiths. David came out of the closet and, after a series of demeaning one-night stands, found a loyal mate in Keith, played by Matthew St. Patrick. Up until the end, though, that relationship was rocky, and anyone loved by Ruth or Claire had it rockier still. The third and fourth seasons of 6 Feet Under lost their way a bit, but jolted back to life with a punishingly dramatic episode in which David was abducted and nearly killed. And since Nate's death last month, 6 Feet Under has come full circle in a way as satisfying as a great novel. The memory of his son, like his father before him, now haunts his family members to interact, to witness, and just to linger. Here's a scene from Sunday's finale, one that doesn't reveal any sensitive information. Claire is about to leave to take a job in New York as a photographer's assistant when her answering machine picks up a bad news call from the guy who hired her. Claire doesn't pick up the phone to talk to him, but when the call is over, her dead brother Nate, who appears to her suddenly, starts his own conversation with her.
Claire, hi, this is Gavin at New Image, and I hate to be the one to tell you this, but New Image has been bought by Stock Options, and they're consolidating their operations, and, well, they're in Chicago. So, I hope you haven't headed out here yet. Sorry.
Ah, who cares? Go anyway.
What, are you crazy? I'm gonna move to New York City without a job?
Mom gave you the money. You're gonna land somewhere. You'll be fine. You're talented. You're smart. You're ready.
What if I'm not?
Claire, you wanna know a secret? I spent my whole life being scared. Scared of not being ready, of not being right, of not being who I should be. Where did it get me?
I won't tell you anything about what happens in Sunday's finale, but I will tell you that Alan Ball, who wrote and directed it, finishes 6 Feet Under in a fashion that's so fitting and provides such closure that it ranks on my personal list as the third best TV series ending of all time. Considering that spots 1 and 2 are held respectively by the dream-ending treat on Newhart and the autistic daydream shocker on St. Elsewhere, that's about as much praise as I can generate. The man who concocted the ending of 6 Feet Under, and the beginning, and much of what happened in between, is Alan Ball. Before making 6 Feet Under for HBO, Alan Ball won an Oscar for his screenplay for American Beauty, another character-driven comedy drama in which the central character dies. Ball started out as a playwright, before shifting to TV and writing for sitcoms such as Grace Under Fire and Sybil. Terry spoke with Alan Ball in June 2001, shortly after 6 Feet Under was launched. She began by asking him how HBO executives reacted when he showed them the completed pilot.
We had a meeting, and they said, it feels a little safe. It feels a little network. Could you make the whole thing just a little more screwed up? Well, I had never gotten a note like that in TV.
Right.
And I just sort of, you know, looked up at the ceiling and said, thank you, God. And I said, yeah, I can definitely screw it up. And I didn't go in and screw things up just for the sake of that. But, it, you know, when they said that to me, I sort of felt like I had carte blanche to really go into the nooks and crannies of these characters' psyches. And then it got really interesting.
Can you give us an example of something that was less screwed up initially that got more screwed up after you got that suggestion?
Well, in the pilot, you know, Nate meets Brenda at the airport and they have sex.
Just for people who aren't following the series, Nate is the brother. Okay,
he's the prodigal son. He's the oldest son,
right,
who left home because he did not want to go into the business.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been sort of a Peter Pan, you know, hippie, basically. And he comes home for the Christmas holidays. And his father's killed in a car accident on the way to the airport to pick him up. But in the pilot, he meets this woman on the plane, Brenda, and she's kind of very, very sexually assertive, and they end up having sex in a broom closet. And then in my original draft, she just was kind of really nice, and then she showed up at the funeral and said, you know, after Nate has this scene where he sort of insists on picking up the dirt actually with his bare hands and throwing it into the grave, as opposed to a more sanitized procedure that's standard for the funeral home. And she sees that, and she sort of goes, wow, you know, that was really impressive. So she was just basically kind of like the nice girlfriend, you know. And so I went back, and I made her a little more brittle and a little more mysterious, and put in a phone call where, you know, she calls him, and, you know, just to check out how he's doing. And he sort of flirts with her and says something along the lines of, you know, he sort of like calls her on some of her stuff, and she just snaps and says to him, you think you're not easy to read? You know, guys like you are good for, you know, a roll in the hay, and that's it. And she hangs up the phone. It just sort of makes it more complicated, you know?
Why don't we play back that phone call that you just described?
Hello?
You are always
well, it's about to start raining frogs here. How are things on your end?
God, I'm glad you called.
Really? Why?
I don't know. Because you, thought you have a calming effect on me?
Uh-huh. Are you familiar with the psychological term projection?
Oh, are you familiar with the psychological term bl***** me? Come on. You grew up with all that psychobabble.
rebelled against it every chance you got, still do. And that includes having sex with strangers in closets at airports.
And you think you're not easy to read? Coasting by on your looks and charm isn't working like it used to, but you have no idea what else to do because you've never had to learn. Any woman with half a brain looks at a guy like you and thinks, good for a hot f***, but believe me, that's it.
Alan Ball, I'm glad you brought up the character of Nate's girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Because in some ways, I still don't know what to make of her. I don't know whether she's a kind of really smart person, a life force, or whether she's really troubled, whether she's beneath all of this, a really troubled person who's going to do a lot of damage as the series plays out.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to be confused?
At this point, yeah. A lot about Brenda gets explained over the course of the first season. A lot of why she is the way she is explained, and you understand where she comes from. And she's also, underneath that, she's incredibly vulnerable, much more than she would even like to admit to herself. And we eventually get to that place. But what was interesting to me about Nate and Brenda, as opposed to, you know, the traditional, they're kind of like the Hope and Michael from 30-something of our show. But the traditional sort of main couple of a show is usually very well adjusted and very, you know, committed and very good about expressing their feelings. And these are two people who don't have any experience in a long-term relationship for their own reasons. And they're both smart and they're both good people, but they don't necessarily have the skills to maintain a relationship. But they're both at points in their lives where they kind of want to do that. And I also think, you know, in my mind, overlooking the entire course of the series, there's a little bit of fate involved in the two of them being together.
Now, I find that I usually resist new series until after a couple of episodes or more, the characters finally get under my skin and mm-hmm. I get really interested in them. I think I have a very crowded brain that feels already overpopulated with characters and plot
Absolutely.
Lines.
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you think of yourself as having to fight against that when you're writing a pilot? Because in the pilot, you have to do a lot of work. You have to not only make it interesting, but you have to introduce a whole cast of characters, introduce mm-hmm. the basic plot of the series, mm-hmm. and keep resistant people like me interested.
Mm-hmm. One of the great things about working at HBO as opposed to working at the broadcast networks, just based on my own limited experience with the broadcast networks, is that HBO is constantly encouraging me to really get into the character psyches and get into the, you know, the stuff that's not so pretty, the warts, the neuroses. And as a writer, I've always been drawn to those characters because, well, number one, I can relate to them more than I can relate to, like, the perfect heroes or heroines. And number two, my heart goes out to them. I love characters who are trying to make sense of their lives and trying to live an authentic life in an increasingly inauthentic world, but they're not totally equipped and they're just kind of acting on blind faith and, you know, really, you know, making mistakes and their lives are messy. I find that much more poignant and much more captivating than, you know, your totally perfect hero or your completely nurturing, you know, wife, mother, heroine, that kind of thing. I just don't, those archetypes don't interest me. And plot actually doesn't interest me as much as character. And so in the pilot of 6 Feet Under, I felt like, you know, there's nothing like a death, a cataclysmic event to really bring, it just sort of peels away a layer of skin. And you get to see how people really are underneath the armor that they wear through daily life and the masks that they wear through daily life. And those are the moments to me that are always interesting. And usually pilots I've worked on before, there's so much studio involvement, there's so much network involvement, and you're constantly being told to spoon feed information about the characters to the audience. Whereas at HBO, it was just like, just let the behavior speak for itself.
Alan Ball speaking with Terry Gross. 6 Feet Under airs its final episode on Sunday. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Alan Ball, the creator of HBO's 6 Feet Under. She spoke with him in 2001, shortly after the show began.
Now, I'll tell you something that surprised me. At the end of the latest episode, episode 4, several people at the end of the show actually seem to learn a lesson and grow. You know, a gang leader learns to have empathy with his dead homie's parents. The daughter seems to learn she probably doesn't want to flirt with gangs and guns. And David, the brother who's been in the business for a while, kind of learns a lesson from the corpse. I should say here that the corpse usually talks to
Well, David's the guy who
spends people in the funeral home. Yeah.
Yeah. He spends a lot of his time with dead people, you know. And that, of course, is not meant I'm not implying that these people are actually ghosts. These are manifestations of interior dialogues that he's having with himself.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I think as you watch the series, people do learn lessons and then they backtrack. You know, it's one step forward, two steps back. But you know, while I feel like a lot of the lesson learned moments in network TV seem to me very saccharine and very superficial, I don't think that one should necessarily just try to avoid those moments altogether, because we do learn lessons in life. But what we attempt to do is for it to be tempered, for it to be realistic. But people have profound moments in their lives. And in a show that is about how the constant presence of death throws your own life into stark relief, I think people will have profound moments. Are you familiar with the writer Thomas Lynch?
Yeah, the poet who's also an undertaker.
Yeah, well, you know, I did a lot of research when I started working on the show, and his books had the most profound effect on me just in terms of the tone of how they were written. And there's a certain reverence for life, but at the same time, just a completely unsentimental acceptance of the fact that it is fleeting. And so I think that's what I'm attempting to do in the moments where people, you know, people do learn things. People do become aware of things. People's consciousnesses expand. But at the same time, it's a constant struggle because you always want to fall back.
You know, you described the series about living in the constant presence of death. And I know that death really entered your life. I'm not sure if it was for the first time or not, when you were 13 and your sister was killed in a car accident. You were both in the car at the time she was driving. Could I ask you to tell what happened?
Well, my life was very clearly separated into before and after at that moment. She was driving me to a music lesson, and it was her 22nd birthday, and she pulled out in front of a car, and it hit the driver's side, and she was killed instantly, and I was not hurt at all. It was profoundly shocking and traumatic moment in my life, and you know, I will carry deep scars from that moment until the day I die. And then there was a lot of blood, and in the ambulance, I said, "Is she going to be okay?" And instead of just telling me, "No, she's dead," they said, yes, she's going to be okay. They took me to the hospital, and I was I was thinking, well, she's going to be okay. She's going to be okay. I was holding on to that. And then our family doctor came and picked me up and was driving me back to meet my parents. And he said, "You're going to have to be strong for your parents." And I said, "Well, why, you know, she's going to be okay, isn't she?" And he said, "No." And there was a moment where a very distinct physical sensation of just the bottom dropping out from under me at that moment. And my family, I wouldn't call them dysfunctional because there was no abuse or no addictions or anything like that. But certainly we were not particularly skilled in intimacy. And what happened is that everybody sort of splintered and went into their own little world. And I think that's certainly there is a dynamic of that in the Fishers, in that people really kind of, even though they're a family and they share the same house, they exist separate as separate entities. And that to me is what gives the show fertile ground, because as these people move towards each other and start to reach out to each other, that's, I think, where you can really mine that for some great drama and some great comedy.
Alan Ball, the creator of 6 Feet Under, speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. The show's final episode, which Ball wrote and directed, airs Sunday night on HBO. We'll hear more of their interview in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and Barnes & Noble, publishers of portable professor audio courses, including masterpieces of Western music, classics from the Baroque to the modern. Additional support for NPR comes from Dial Press, publisher of Temple Stream, A Rural Odyssey, a nonfiction narrative that explores the Maine countryside by Bill Rohrbach. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue with Alan Ball, the creator of 6 Feet Under. The series finale airs this Sunday. We also hear from two stars of the show, Michael C. Hall, who plays David, and Lauren Ambrose, who plays Claire. And David Edelstein reviews the films Red Eye and The 40-Year-Old Virgin. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. We're back with Terry's interview with Alan Ball, the creator of the HBO series 6 Feet Under. The final episode airs Sunday night. 6 Feet Under is about a family that owns and runs a funeral home and lives in the constant presence of death. Alan Ball's sister died in a car crash when he was 13.
What was your sister's funeral like?
It was surreal. It was very surreal. It was, you know, the traditional open casket thing. And I remember the first time I saw her in the open casket, I thought, okay, who's that? Because they had done her completely different. They'd given her like big boofy hair, which she never wore in life. It was like a lipstick color that she would never wear. And I'm sorry, you know, when they lay those bodies out in caskets, they look phony. They look like wax figures, and it's certainly for me, and I'm not saying I'm not saying that this is true for everybody. It was not at all comforting to see that. And there was a point where my mom just broke down and started to cry, and somebody from the funeral home just appeared out of nowhere and silently swooped her off into this room and shut the drape. And that moment is very, I put that moment in the pilot because I'll never forget that, because the subtext of that moment is, oh, these emotions are it's, they're, no, you shouldn't see this. This is bad. You shouldn't have this kind of emotion. The way that we should deal with this is very quiet, very muffled. Keep everything down. Well, no, that's a lie. Because what you need to do is you need to scream. You need to bang on the wall. You need to, like, tear at your hair. Because grief is a primal, primal thing. And the only way out of it is through it. And, you know, it took me 25 years to learn that, because I never really grieved for my sister. Because, number one, I was told to stay strong for my parents. Number two, I just didn't have the skills. I didn't know what you were supposed to feel, how you were supposed to express it. It was too overwhelming. It was too terrifying. And so I carried that grief, that unexpressed grief, around for 20 years.
Well, you know, I thought maybe I could play a scene here. You know, you're talking about the importance of grief and how, like, at your sister's funeral, the funeral director tried to cover that up by escorting your grieving mother behind behind a curtain. There's a scene I want to play from the end of an episode, because it's the first episode, in which the father's being buried, and the one of the sons, the prodigal son who's come back, wants to throw fistfuls of dirt onto the coffin, as opposed to, as you describe it, the more sanitized, symbolic version of throwing dirt onto the coffin, which is what this funeral home usually practices. And his brother, who has been in the funeral business for a while, gets really angry with him for acting out like that, and for showing his anger and grief in public. And this is the conversation they have between them about what the appropriate way to behave is.
You want to be the alpha dog, Nate? Is that it? Coasting toward midlife with nothing to show for it. Now you want to come back and be the rock for this family to lean on? F*** you.
That is not what
you want to get your hands dirty? You sanctimonious prick, talk to me when you've had to stuff formaldehyde-soaked cotton up your father's ass so he doesn't leak.
Jesus.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you just would have tossed him out with the garbage. It may seem weird to you, but there is a reason behind everything that we do here. We provide people with a very important and sacred service at the darkest time in their lives, because maybe they don't want to make a spectacle of themselves, because maybe they prefer to grieve in private.
Why? Why does it have to be such a secret? It's nothing to be ashamed of. Dave, please.
Pat, you know nothing. Nothing. You had a responsibility to this family. And you ran away from it, and you left it all for me.
Whoa, don't blame me if you're not living the life you want. That is nobody's fault but your own.
Okay. Fine, just do me a favor, okay? You got out. Stay out.
Is there anything you want to say about writing that scene, Alan Ball?
Well, I think there's, yeah, I mean, because I think they both have valid viewpoints. I don't think Nate is the hero and David is the villain at all, because Nate is so self-righteous when he says, when he's telling David, you can't go through this without getting your hands dirty. He's telling this to a man who constantly, you know, who constantly prepares dead bodies. And that's what Nate was afraid of and Nate ran away from. And in David's mind, of course, he abdicated his responsibility and left David with no choice but to go into this business. I think it's, I also think, you know, the thing about the relationship between Nate and David is that the bedrock of that relationship is just this fierce love for each other. But because of the various ways that their lives have taken them, they can't communicate that. And so that passion gets rechanneled into anger and resentment.
Alan Ball, speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. He's the creator of 6 Feet Under and wrote and directed Sunday's final episode. Michael C. Hall is one of the stars of 6 Feet Under. He plays David Fisher, who's more straight-laced, business-oriented, and uptight than his older brother Nate. David also is gay, which he kept a secret from everyone, including his family, until the second season of the show. Here's a scene from the first episode of that season. His mother was trying to figure out how to be supportive of her son, and at the same time, how to let her children know that she's having a relationship with Dimitri, the owner of the flower shop where she works. In this scene, she's telling the family that she's invited Dimitri to a family dinner so they can get acquainted.
Nate, I'd like you to invite Brenda. Claire, I'd like you to invite Gabriel Dimas. And David, if you have a special friend, I'd like for him to come as well.
Why is my friend special?
All right. If you're having sex with anyone, I'd like to meet him. Is that better?
Not really.
Stop acting like children! Are you seeing anyone?
No.
Well, why not? Sex is an important and healthy part of life. It's nothing to be ashamed of.
Yes, I know that. Unfortunately, I'm not having any right now.
What happened to that cop? The black man.
He met someone else.
Terry Gross spoke with Michael C. Hall in 2002.
When you auditioned, did you know which brother you were auditioning for?
Yeah, I was asked to read for the part of David from the beginning, and when I read the script, I think I responded to that role. Because, of course, I had it in mind, but I think I would have anyway, just because, you know, if drama is conflict, David is inherently dramatic because he's conflicted over his sexuality, of course, but also his relationship to his family, to his work, to his religious life even. They're all characterized by conflict.
So what did you have to do to prove yourself against the other David Fishers?
I don't know. I think in spite of the fact that on paper, I suppose I'm very different from David, there was something that I did immediately respond to in terms of having a sense of how he might express himself or how he walked or breathed, or I don't know, that sense of resenting what you imagine to be a lack of appreciation for all the sacrifices you've made for all the other people in your life. And not that I am fueled by resentment, but I guess I knew what that was about somehow, and took that as a starting point.
What do people most ask you about in terms of the plot? What do people most want to know?
Early on, people were interested in who burned down the house.
Right.
But I guess usually specific questions about the show have to do with my character, because of course they're talking to me. And I've had a woman recognize me and tell me she loves the show, and then put her hand on my arm and tell me that she hopes that I'm going to be okay. This was about halfway through the first season, which was kind of exciting and creepy simultaneously. There was a guy who walked by me in the locker room of the gym in New York, an older guy, and this was after the season finale when David had had his epiphany in church, and he told me he was glad I was finally starting to behave myself. That's all he said. just said that and walked away. And, a New York fireman walked up and recognized me from the show and said, "Are you going to get back together with that cop? I like you guys," you know, so, which is great.
I do too. I also think you should get back together.
Good.
Here comes a question that you might not want to answer. So,
okay.
I'll just remind you, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to.
Right.
Because you play a gay character,
right?
Probably a lot of viewers wonder if you are gay or straight yourself, and how you feel about playing a gay character in the series.
Right. Well, my first impulse is to say, well, what does it matter? But I think the fact that the character has resonance is why it matters. People inevitably have varying degrees of preoccupation with sexual orientation. I'm not gay. No one ever asked me if I'm a mortician, you know, but...
We know you're not.
I'm an actor. Right. I'm not gay. I'm not a mortician. I'm an only child, not a middle child. So I'm you know, it's a bit of internal alchemy and imaginative work that is why I do what I do. And I'm really honored to breathe life into the character because I recognize, as I think a lot of people do, that he's a pretty unique creation in terms of a character on television or film or really anywhere I've seen, and that he's a complex flesh and blood, you know, person who's not incidentally gay and is not the understanding neighbor upstairs or the comic relief. His relationship to his sexuality is very complicated, and I think that's unique. So I feel a sense of responsibility, and I'm honored to play the part.
Michael C. Hall, who plays David in 6 Feet Under. He spoke with Terry Gross in 2002. Coming up, we hear from Lauren Ambrose, who plays David's sister Claire. This is Fresh Air. Our final voice from 6 Feet Under is that of Lauren Ambrose, who plays Claire, the youngest and only female sibling in the Fisher family. When the show began, Claire was in high school. Now she's taken time off from art school, landed and lost a menial white-collar job, and wondered what in the world to do next. Earlier this season, she moved in with her emotionally and mentally unstable boyfriend Billy and wanted to use her trust fund to travel. But her mother insisted the money was for college. It's one of many things Claire fought about with her mother. Here's a scene from earlier in this season.
Don't you think it's significant that whenever I make a decision for myself, you hate me?
I don't hate you. I hate your choices.
Look at me! I am an adult, and my choices are none of your business. You had no right to call that lawyer. Dad loved me. He wanted me to be happy. That's why he left me the money.
He did not intend to finance you while you play house with a crazy person.
Oh, look who's talking. He wanted you to be educated, to learn, to go to college.
I am learning from life.
You don't even know what college is. You never went. That was your choice. And now you hate yourself for it, so you're going to take it out on me?
That is not true.
Then stop being such a controlling bitch and give me my money. I will hit you back this time. Billy and I are moving to Spain, and you can't stop us.
Get out of my house!
Claire's mother, Ruth, is played by Frances Conroy. The character of Claire is so well written and performed, it's easy to feel like you know her. I asked Lauren Ambrose about the reaction she gets to her character.
It's funny, everybody says, that's me, that was me in high school, it's me now. And sometimes I wonder if it's because Claire gets to say so many witty quips from the pen of Alan Ball and other very clever people that we all wish we could be as clever as Claire some days.
At what point did you know what the ending was going to be for your character and the others? Did you know when they gave you the script, or did you know before that?
Well, we didn't know what was going to happen in the final episode until Alan wrote it. We kind of knew vaguely a trajectory of the season. And we knew that this would be the final season from the very beginning. Alan called us at the beginning and called us each and said, this is it. We're going to be working towards the end. And he sounded inspired and excited to make this final season. And he sounded like he had a lot of ideas. So it was just kind of exciting to see what was how they were going to figure out a way to bring an end to this.
Do you have a favorite scene or plot development with your character, Claire?
All of the scenes with Franny Conroy and that arc over the years, the mother-daughter arc has been an interesting one to me. And really all of the scenes in the kitchen. Those have always been my favorite scenes, where it's the four of us sitting in the kitchen And one of my favorite memories of this show was a day that, I think it was the very first season, and Kathy Bates was directing. And I had a scene with Peter Krause, who plays my brother, Nate, and we were just sitting on the washing machine. It was blocked, so we were sitting on the washing machines, and I was going through something dramatic with a boy and very upset about it, and he was comforting me, and it was just a lovely scene between a brother and sister. And we shot the master of it, and then people always, in television, they always go in and shoot coverage. You shoot a master, and then you shoot the coverage, and then you shoot the coverage closer, or maybe you do a different shot or a move or something else, and then they have all of these choices to choose from. And I said, oh, and Kathy, and so we shot the master, and it was really lovely, and it was just this two shot of us sitting on the washing machine, and Kathy said, that was great, let's move in and get coverage. And I said, oh, do we have to? And she said, no. And then I got really nervous, because then there was nothing to hide behind. But it ended up, that ended up being in the show, and it was just this, just exactly what we did.
Well, why don't we actually hear the scene that you've just described?
Is he your boyfriend?
No. Just, he needs me. It was the first time in my life I felt important. Like someone needed me, you know, like not just like some annoying extra person just lumped in with everyone else. No one's ever needed me.
I need you.
Right. I felt this really intense connection. I was just gone. And I want it back. I want him back. Is there something wrong with me? Is there something about me that makes me deserve something like this?
Deserve what?
Just feeling really close to someone and then having them just disappear. Like I mean nothing.
Claire. Gabe just went to visit his father for a day. I think you're talking about Dad. Look, we never talk about him. That's okay. That's what you want. But at some point, you're going to have to deal with how you feel.
Oh, God, can't I just get upset without having to focus on what's really making me upset?
Well, it worked for me for 34 years.
Lauren Ambrose and Peter Krause in a scene from the first season of 6 Feet Under. This Sunday, 6 Feet Under ends its 5-year run. A DVD collection of the fourth season of the show will be released Tuesday, and we expect to have a new interview with Alan Ball discussing the ending of 6 Feet Under early next week. Coming up, movies, a new thriller, and a new comedy. This is Fresh Air. Wes Craven has a new thriller called Red Eye, and Steve Carell stars in a new comedy called The 40-Year-Old Virgin. Two films that critic David Edelstein says do just what late summer movies are supposed to do.
It's the third week of August, and the studios assume we're all too hot and stupid to sit through anything of substance. Well, here's what I say to Hollywood. You're right. It does seem about time for a good empty multiplex thriller and a good empty multiplex sex comedy. We've got a very good empty thriller and a pretty good empty sex comedy. Let's start with Wes Craven's Red Eye, a minimalist exercise in maximalist suspense. Hey, do you think that would fit in an ad? It's mostly two people sitting next to each other on an airplane. There are lots of close-ups, lots of Hitchcockian subjective camera shots up and down the aisle. Rachel McAdams plays Lisa, a luxury hotel manager flying home to Miami after her grandmother's funeral. McAdams had to deal with Owen Wilson's subterfuge in The Wedding Crashers, but it's nothing on what Cillian Murphy pulls here. Murphy battled zombies in 28 Days Later and put a bag over his head that spewed poisonous gas in Batman Begins. With his pallor and his glazed blue eyes, he's right on the border between Dreamboat and Spooky Freak. He and Lisa meet cute in the airport, and cute again when they share Bay Breeze cocktails, and cute once more when it turns out he's sitting next to her on the plane.
Oh. Hi. Again.
I figured you'd be in first class.
Oh, no, no, not me. I'm all coach all the time.
Me too.
Yeah. I think that's my seat.
What, you're not sitting here?
Well, I don't know. That's his 18G.
You're kidding. You're not kidding. Yeah, you need a bellhop?
No, that's okay.
Can we please?
Okay. Oh.
You okay?
Yeah.
You sure?
Yeah. I'm not normally such a lightweight. Some strong bay breezes.
Oh, I'm cutting you off anyway, sorry. So, what are the odds, huh?
Yeah, I know.
Wait a minute. You're not stalking me, are you?
No.
Stalking him, that's a good one. I really like the flatness of the film's setup. It's very creepy. And the movie gets even creepier once we learn what he wants Lisa to do for him. This is the sort of witty thriller that comes down to props and characters as props. A pen, a book, a friendly old lady, a curious little girl, a plane phone, a cell phone, a people mover. Red Eye does get more conventional as it approaches the climax. You know, girl running from stalking killer with a knife. But this is Wes Craven of Scream and Scream 2 and, oh yeah, Scream 3. And listen, this guy knows stalking killer with a knife scenes. Red Eye takes off and lands in 85 minutes, including credits, just the right length, and you don't even have to switch planes. If you want a good time with the 40-year-old version, then, in the words of another sex-crazed dork, John Lovitz, lower your standards. Certainly the writer-director Judd Apatow and writer-star Steve Carell have lowered theirs. Apatow was a writer and director on The Larry Sanders Show and Freaks and Geeks. Carell has been a hoot on The Daily Show and was brilliant as the lead in the ill-advised Americanization of The Office. But here's what happens when genius TV comedy guys do big studio multiplex movies. They put on their stupid hats and try to gross you out. Carell plays Andy, a permanent adolescent who lives among vintage monster models and other geeky bric-a-brac. There's very visible evidence of a sex drive, but he's mostly in a world of audio-video fantasy, at least outside his job, at an audio-video superstore. Over poker, his co-workers trade obnoxious and disgusting stories about their sex lives. Then all eyes turn to Andy.
Andy, do me a favor. Would you please help him redeem himself by telling a real sex story?
Yes.
I don't, you know what? I'm a gentleman and I don't, you know, I don't kiss and tell. So.
I'm paying you the nastiest thing you've ever done. I'm dead serious. I'm talking about nasty.
Wow. So many stories are running through my head right now. I dated this girl for a while and she was really a nasty freak. She just loved to get down with sex all the time. She was like, any time of day, she was like, yeah, let's go. I'm so nasty.
She talked dirty to you?
Oh, she loved to dirty talk. Totally into it. She'd be like, oh, me so horny. Me love you long time. So.
The 40-year-old virgin is too long, too sexist, and too, shall we say, flaccid. Partly it's because Carell hasn't quite settled on a character. His jittery white guy anti-hipness is amusing. But first he's a half-wit bordering on a quarter-wit who doesn't even know how a condom works. Then he's a savvy charmer. But the movie has its moments. There's a great scene when Andy's buddies introduce him to a surefire conquest, an outrageous alcoholic played by Leslie Mann. She and Andy get into her car for the ultimate don't try this at home kids drunk driving scene. And Catherine Keener shows up as a been around the block mom who instantly falls for Andy for no reason I can discern. But Keener is such a smart and grounded performer that she makes you believe almost anything. Even that she's worth waiting 40 years to have sex with.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez-Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Warner Home Video, presenting Alexander, Director's Cut, introducing Oliver Stone's final cut of his epic film, available on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, with oil prices soaring, we talk about how much oil is actually in Saudi Arabian reserves and what problems lie ahead with journalist Peter Moss. His article, The Breaking Point, is the cover story of this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Join us for the next Fresh Air.